From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A U.S.-led security force in northern Syria came under fire from Syrian forces this week in a rare direct interaction between the troops of both countries. The Syrian government has been relentlessly bombarding the rebel-held area of Idlib in northern Syria, causing nearly 750,000 Syrians to flee in what the United Nations has called the single largest exodus from the 9-year-long war. In spite of peace talks that were held last fall in Geneva and expectations that the war might be wrapping up, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad appears to have been emboldened to continue the attacks, along with his allies, the Russian and Iranian governments. Meanwhile, tensions with neighboring Turkey have increased after a number of Turkish soldiers were killed by the Syrian government earlier this month. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Simone.
So it's been 9 years since the war began, and as I mentioned, there were peace talks last year. Some had high expectations, others were more cynical, and now it seems as though the war is just continuing as it did before. Why is Syria bombarding Idlib? Is that the last place held by rebels that Assad feels stands between him and complete control?
Yeah, so there are two things going on, I guess. One is, yes, it is the last rebel stronghold, and it has been a rebel stronghold for almost all this this period. But also, there were a number of brokered agreements where, for example, in Homs and Aleppo, where Syrian forces were bombarding the cities, and at some point there were agreements to allow some of the rebels safe passage out in exchange essentially for acknowledging that the Syrian government had won that battle. And so most of those people are now in Idlib as well. So it's a mix of what you might call the rebels who actually have a support base in the region, other fighters, some of them extremists who came in as a result of these agreements, and of course, the local population.
So what happened with Turkey? And why are there Turkish forces in Syria to begin with?
Well, the reason there are Turkish forces in Syria is the sort of self-assertion of the Syrian Kurds, which is a long and complicated story, but I guess the relevant part is that in the last several years, the United States has elevated them and made them into their primary shock troops in fighting ISIS. So that campaign, the campaign against Raqqa, was a joint operation between Syrian Kurdish armed forces and U.S. air support with a few special forces. Of course, in that campaign, in addition to routing ISIS from Raqqa, they killed about 1,600 civilians, something that rarely gets mentioned. But anyway, this the combined assertion of the Syrian Kurds and the United States sort of pushing them up to prominence were all just like waving red flags in front of the Turkish government. And it probably would have been the case no matter who was in charge of the Turkish government. And so, especially when Trump created a power vacuum by announcing that he was going to once again betray the Kurds, as the United States does so many times, Erdogan sees that opportunity to move in and force.
So Turkish forces moved in, but also then came under fire, and now Erdogan and is predictably angry, and Iran is offering to mediate between the Syrian government and the Turkish government. Could this be a new flashpoint that opens up in the war, or are you just expecting it to be sort of a temporary issue?
It's very strange. If you look at the evolutions of the Turkish government since the beginning, for many years they were very much on the side of the rebels. This had to do, among other things, with ideological affinities between Erdogan's Muslim Brotherhood and some of the rebel groups. So they were very much against the Assad government. They've had clashes with Russia before, but right now, with the U.S. Leaving the, as I said, the power vacuum, Russia is the sort of dominant power that has essentially a veto over anything that goes on. So Turkey has had to reach a rapprochement with Russia. The Syrian government is now pretty much in control, except, of course, in this last stronghold of Idlib. So there's no serious thought, I think, among the Turks of taking on the Syrian government for control of any significant part of Syria. And their main focus has shifted away from supporting the anti-government rebels to suppressing the Syrian Kurds.
So with U.S. troops coming under fire this week, that tells us that there are still U.S. troops in Syria, right?
Well, you know, when Trump says something, I mean, who knows what it means, right? He says something, he changes his mind back and forth. Yes, if anything, it was a pretty particularly bizarre instance where he announced U.S. vulnerability by saying that he was withdrawing, but then left troops in there to be potentially in the line of fire.
So let's talk about the exodus of refugees. This has been one of the bloodiest wars of the past decade, if not the bloodiest. And just in the past 10 weeks alone, we've seen upwards of 700,000 refugees flee the bombing, not just by the Syrian government, but by its allies, the Russians. Are they all fleeing from Idlib? You know, where are these refugees fleeing from, and where are they going?
Right. So the latest waves of refugees are primarily from Idlib, and Syria has two problems. One is there's a very large number of refugees outside the country, but there's also a very large number of what's called internally displaced persons. So the question of where they're going for many of them probably has yet to be resolved, especially because it's not nearly as easy as it used to be to get to Europe, and because many of the refugees who have gotten to Europe, especially in places like Greece, are in conditions only one step up from being under bombardment.
And we're not seeing nearly enough coverage of this refugee crisis these days in U.S. media as we're seeing in, say, Al Jazeera. I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if that's because of the U.S., on paper pulling out troops or fatigue, or just that the election is eating up so much oxygen. Even the left is not really paying that much attention, whether that's because of misinformation or pro-Syria propaganda. It's not quite clear, but it's just something that's just become this footnote in the news headlines.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I mean, yes, of course, the election year is part of it. That's always the case with American politics. That it sort of drowns everything else out. But I think that the left also now has very little occasion to be engaged in and interested in this, because A, for a long time, anybody who actually thinks about these issues has not known what to call for. Most people are up in arms about a non-existent U.S. offensive against, Syrian hospitals, and paying no attention to actual U.S. offensives like the one I mentioned against Raqqa. The left has no coherent, morally superior plan or analysis of any of this, so it doesn't even have any particular occasion for trying to raise any kind of consciousness among other people, which means it's left with basically nothing to do, and those people on the left with a conscience and who actually care about what's happening in Syria probably don't want to simply depress themselves by learning more when they cannot figure out anything to call for. And of course, it's also exacerbated by the fact that any kind of pressure with regard to human rights is going to fall on deaf ears with this administration.
Who continues to back the Syrian rebels then? Going back to what the government is doing in Idlib, what the Syrian government is, who it's targeting in Idlib, the Syrian rebels that remain in that part of northern Syria, are they essentially on their own? Are they getting arms from somewhere? And how long can they hold out against the might of the Syrian government and all of its allies?
Well, you know, at this point, the current funding sources are absolutely not clear to me. In the past, of course, there was a trickle of money from the United States. There was some support from Jordan because of American auspices. And there was money coming in from the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Right now, I think many of the rebels or ex-rebels are in such desperate states that, for example, circumstances that, for example, many of them essentially signed on with Turkey for its offensive against the Kurds. Another reason for that may be that there have been, in fact, many clashes between the Sunni Arab rebels and the Kurds. And so right now, it's very hard to say, like I said, without inside information, but my guess is they have very little in the way of external funding, and they're simply subsisting on whatever they can extract from the population.
And does Russia and Iran's backing continue to prop up the Syrian government as well, a government that had been internationally isolated, but for these two very strong allies that have stuck with it for 9 years?
It's hard to imagine that the Syrian government would have been able to weather this storm without the early intervention of Hezbollah, followed by massive Iranian involvement, and then in 2015, the Russians. And right now, again, I mean, I don't see any possibility of fruitfully opposing them, especially with Russia, the only supposed superpower that is, you know, maintaining any significant presence in the region. So yes, they have propped up the Syrian regime, they have enabled the genocide, and of course, they have also been a real part of deliberate commission of war crimes, like the incredible amount of evidence of Russians deliberately targeting Syrian hospitals.
I understand that there are airstrikes by Russia and then Syrian forces on the ground. It seems as though they might be closing in. Are Turkish forces heading towards Idlib? Could there be a confrontation between Turkish forces, Syrian rebels, and Syrian forces in Idlib? Or is that far-fetched?
Well, that's what some people are saying now. Ankara has certainly sent some reinforcements to the rebels, but it's hard to imagine that they are going to be able to intervene in any significant way. Again, you know, the forces against the rebels are overwhelming.
By essentially giving a green light to Turkey, has the U.S. cast its lot officially against the Syrian government?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, technically, I suppose if you want to look at the level of rhetoric ever since the Obama administration, the United States has been against the Syrian government and in favor of regime change. They simply haven't been doing anything about that. And as far as I know, the Trump administration has not officially reversed that overall stance. It's just that, of course, they have done virtually nothing against the Syrian government at any point. And Turkey is simply not an adequate proxy to take on the Syrian government, Iranian forces, and Russia.
Are there any plans for future international peace talks? We mentioned that Turkey and Russia, that Turkey and Syria were holding peace talks with Iran, attempting to mediate, but from an international perspective, just in terms of addressing the Syrian war more broadly, are there future talks planned?
Well, I certainly don't know of any plans that would involve the United States. And I mean, let's be clear that it's been many years since there were peace talks that were actually about, potentially about, a comprehensive settlement. Talks in the last few years have been mostly about what they call deconfliction, temporary truces. There's been, I think, an understanding that all of this is simply about making sure that the various outside powers meddling in Syria don't step on each other's toes too much. It's been years since there's been, I think, a serious possibility of a negotiated settlement in which Assad would not retain full control over Syria.
And by the way, I should mention that Turkey is saying that it has killed 51 Syrian soldiers so far since it sort of hit back in Idlib. And so the Turkey-Syria, the Syrian war looks at least in part to be turning into a Turkey-Syria conflict. And just for the people of Syria who have now been, you know, sitting through this war for nearly a decade, one wonders, what is there left to bomb? In the middle of all of this, where is ISIS in Syria? The Kurds were being seen as a bulwark against ISIS expansion in Syria, but now they've been driven out or dissipated. Where is ISIS in all of this?
Well, I think ISIS is now just a ragged remnant. It has no territorial base. There are obviously people from ISIS in Idlib, along with many other kinds of rebels. In the absence of, again, another territorial power vacuum, I don't consider that ISIS is likely to become an important player in the region again. I mean, obviously there are individual incidents, like the claims from the Iraqis that it was actually ISIS and not Qataib Hezbollah that attacked the American base and set off the bizarre chain of events leading to Trump's decision to assassinate Qasem Soleimani. So things like that can still happen, but ISIS is not an important force now as it was when it held Raqqa.
Are you disappointed, Rahul, that there hasn't been much mention of the Syria war in the United States' political discourse as we are in an election year? There's been a lot of debate so far during the election campaigns among Democratic candidates. Iraq and Afghanistan do come up sometimes, but Syria almost never.
I guess in a way I'm not particularly disappointed because I do not expect anything intelligent to be said about it by any of the presidential candidates, including Bernie Sanders, who, I think what he says in general about foreign policy is marginally better than what it was in 2016 when it was just, I have to say, just stupid. I mean, he simultaneously said we're not going to get into any wars and do anything, and we're going to end ISIS. I'm not sure how he was exactly going to do that, perhaps with Sweden-style socialism. I can't imagine that A, that any of them would say anything intelligent about Syria, B, that any of them is capable of saying anything intelligent about Syria, and C, that if they did, it would help them in any way during this election cycle. I guess if I had to name a disappointment, it would be that it would be nice if they said anything intelligent about climate change, which has also pretty much not happened.
Right. And of course, the U.S. remains so far removed from what's happening in Syria, half a world away. If anything, the question of refugees becomes critically important. But a lot of the Syrian refugees who are attempting to leave the area altogether are heading primarily to Europe, which has also closed many doors. We had the Brexit vote going through, which has now cut the UK off, for the most part, from accepting refugees. The exodus continues, but the doors to refugees are closing, right?
Yes, they are. And I guess I do want to add one thing, which is the United States has basically abdicated any potential responsibility for what happens in Syria. And it may seem that there is nothing to be done, but I think it's important to remember, A, you know, Assad is like Trump. He's a gangster. He's not as much of a coward as Trump is, but they both have the same basic gangster mentality. And once he has pacified Idlib, we just have no idea what kind of reprisals will take place, what will happen to this massive number of refugees. And here is a place where, not under Trump, but under anything remotely approaching a civilized president, the United States could still play a role in pressuring Syria to accept, you know, some kind of reasonably humane final disposition, which would include allowing refugees back without without major reprisals against them, maybe some kind of blanket amnesty. I don't think it's completely impossible if there were a force with sufficient weight pushing on that. But nothing like that has seemed to be in the cards for many years, including under Obama.
Well, Rahul, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for paying attention to these issues. Always appreciate your insight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is our U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent. We've been discussing the latest in the ongoing Syrian war. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.